Doctors visiting a Gaza hospital are stunned by the war's toll on Palestinian children.
It's catastrophic. There are so many injuries. They have overwhelmed the capacity of not just this hospital, but the entire healthcare system that has been targeted and collapsed months ago. And that on top of outbreaks of epidemics, malnutrition.
Ukraine says it will take months to restore energy facilities destroyed by Russian attacks.
Russia hit about 10 regions, dozens of energy facilities, main power plants, and trunk substations. The attack was the worst since the start of the full-scale invasion.
A U.S. journalist is marking 1 year in a Russian prison in a conversation on the growing global threat of extreme heat. Today is Thursday, March 28th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Talks have restarted aimed at bringing top Israeli officials to Washington to discuss potential military operations in the southern Gaza city of Rafah after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled a planned visit this week because he was angry about the U.S. vote on a U.N. ceasefire resolution. White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre.
The Prime Minister's office has agreed to reschedule the meeting dedicated to Rafah. So we're now working with them to find a convenient date that's obviously going to work for both sides.
Israel wants to destroy what it says are four Hamas battalions in Rafah, saying a ground offensive is needed to root them out. That planned incursion has raised global alarm because Rafah is overwhelmed with displaced civilians who've already fled from fighting elsewhere. The U.S., Israel's top ally, and other nations have warned of a humanitarian calamity if Israel launches that offensive in Rafah. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is downplaying concerns from the Biden administration, saying civilians will be able to flee the fighting.
People move down, they can move back up. They don't have to go into north of Wadi Gaza, but there's still 65% of the Gaza Strip left open. And people just move. They move with their tents.
Meanwhile, an international team of doctors visiting a hospital in central Gaza say they were prepared for the worst, but the gruesome impact the war is having on Palestinian children has still left them stunned. Tanya Haj Hassan, a pediatric intensive care doctor from Jordan, was part of a seven-doctor team that recently finished a two-week stint in Gaza.
It's catastrophic. There are so many injuries. They have overwhelmed the capacity of not just this hospital, but the entire healthcare system that has been targeted and collapsed months ago. And that on top of outbreaks of epidemics, malnutrition, and deterioration in people's general health, particularly people with chronic health diseases, you have a system that just is clearly not coping.
Also, Israel has ordered a number of Palestinian hospital patients back to the Gaza Strip after they're done with treatment in East Jerusalem medical facilities. As Linda Gradstein reports from East Jerusalem, the order has sparked outcry from human rights groups, and the Israeli Supreme Court has put their transfer on hold.
In East Jerusalem's Muqassid Hospital, a room is filled with Palestinian women from Gaza and their newborn babies. One of the mothers got pregnant with twins after 7 years of infertility. But when she developed complications late in the pregnancy, her Gazan doctor sent her here for emergency treatment just before the war started in October. Today, her twins, Abdullah and Oday, are healthy five-month-olds. Hanan Sharadan says she'd like to go back to her home, and if it was safe to go back to northern Gaza, she would. But it's not safe, she adds. Her husband says it's better if she stays in Jerusalem, even though he hasn't seen his children yet. These women and their babies, as well as 11 cancer patients in nearby Augusta Victoria Hospital, had already packed their suitcases because they were supposed to be returned to Gaza last week by COGAT, the Israeli army unit which deals with Palestinian civilians. But Physicians for Human Rights, along with two Israeli human rights organizations, appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court, which granted a 30-day stay while COGAT explains its reasons for transferring these patients. An Augusta Victoria cancer patient is concerned about his grandchildren in Gaza, but he's afraid it will be impossible to continue his treatment there. Khaled Sait says that Gaza is destroyed and there is no way to get treatment there. He says the Red Cross is taking patients out of Gaza and Israel wants to send him back. He asks how that is possible. Koga says it is only sending back patients who are not in need of further medical care. But Physicians for Human Rights says Israel is putting them in danger by sending them to a war zone. Asil Aburas works for Physicians for Human Rights, which brought the case to the Israeli Supreme Court.
After chemotherapy and radiotherapy, the body is usually, even if you don't necessarily have another treatment for the next 2 months, for example, your body is still weak. Your immune system is weak. And as you know, in Gaza, the whole healthcare system is under collapse. There's no functioning hospitals. There's no doctors are overwhelmed. They cannot treat cancer patients are being sent abroad.
Treatment for Palestinians at East Jerusalem and Israeli hospitals is entirely paid by the Palestinian Authority. The director of the Augusta Victoria Hospital, Dr. Fadia Trash, says that some of his patients have lost family members and homes during the fighting in Gaza. He hopes patients will be allowed to stay at the hospital until there is a ceasefire.
There is a catastrophe in Gaza. From all the points of view, there is no food, no electricity, no water, nowhere where they can live in a decent way. There will be refugees in Gaza, refugees with cancer in a place in war without any enough supplies.
He says more than 750 cancer patients from Gaza had been scheduled to come for treatment in Israel since the war began. Most have gone to other Arab countries, but some are not getting treatment at all, and they don't know when or where they will find medical care. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, East Jerusalem.
And the families of soldiers still held hostage in Gaza were expected to meet Thursday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the first time since their loved ones were kidnapped into Gaza on October 7th.
We are standing today at the drafting center for Israel's army, where parents bring their kids with the knowledge that the army is responsible to never leave the injured behind.
After 6 months of war and ceasefire and hostage release talks continuing to stall,
we want to know what the plan is to bring them home, and we want to demand their immediate release now from the Prime Minister. It's been too long, and I need my brother back.
Families who have spent months protesting say they feel dejected and unheard by Israel's war cabinet. The Israeli government believes at least 34 of the 130 hostages still in Gaza are dead. Russian forces continue to attack Ukraine with drones and for the first time on Thursday hit the city of Kharkiv with a large caliber guided munition. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has details from Kyiv.
Early morning Thursday, Russian drone attacks targeted Odessa, Kharkiv, Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporizhia regions. Ukrainian air defense destroyed 26 of 28 of the drones. As a result of the attack, debris fell on the residential area in Zaporizhia, injuring at least two people. For the first time since the beginning of the full-scale invasion, Russian forces hit the city of Kharkiv with a large-caliber guided munition. According to preliminary data provided by Ukrainian officials, Russian forces reportedly attacked with a 30-centimeter caliber ammunition that can fly up to 90 kilometers. This type of bomb could be launched from the plane and the Smerch rocket launcher. As a result of the attack, residential buildings and the Institute of Emergency Surgery were damaged. Currently, one person was confirmed killed and 19 injured, including 4 children, local authorities reported. The situation at the Ukraine-Poland border remains tense due to the protests by Polish farmers who demand a new trade policy for agricultural products that are coming from the territory of Ukraine. Meanwhile, on March 28, Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal arrived in Warsaw for intergovernmental consultations with Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, aiming to resolve issues in relations between the two countries. It is expected that the meeting will discuss not only the situation with agriculture and the Polish-Ukrainian border, but also the joint production of ammunition, energy, power transmission, and culture. On March 27, EU ambassadors agreed on a new compromise on the continuation of trade measures for Ukraine, which ensures a balanced approach between supporting Ukraine and protecting EU agricultural markets. The Belgian presidency of the Council of the EU 2024 informed that this compromise still needs to be approved by the European Parliament. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Russia has been stepping up its missile attacks on Ukraine's cities since March 22nd, causing what Ukrainian officials say is the worst damage to the Ukrainian power grid since the start of the full-scale invasion. As Lija Bakalets reports from Kyiv, Ukrainian officials say this is no time for the U.S. to be cutting back military aid to their country.
Months of intensive work, that's how long Ukrainian workers need to restore energy system after the massive Russian attack on March 22nd. Officials say 151 missiles and drones were fired into Ukraine on that single day.
Russia hit about 10 regions, dozens of energy facilities, main power plants, and trunk substations. The attack was the worst since the start of the full-scale invasion.
Ukrainian officials say the worst situation is in the frontline city of Kharkiv, where there are huge power outages.
The electricity disappeared right after the attack and came back 24 hours later. We had it the whole night, and then it was turned off again. But the worst is when people die due to attacks. The infrastructure can be rebuilt.
Rebuilding that infrastructure will be a long and complex process. That is the case with Ukraine's largest hydroelectric power plant. It is currently not functioning after at least 7 Russian missiles hit the plant in the March 22nd attack.
It will take years to restore one of the stations in the plant. The ceiling and walls have collapsed. Damaged metal and concrete structures don't give us access to the engine room on the lower floor. Electrical accessory equipment is 90% destroyed.
Ukrenergo alone calculates the losses from the largest Russian attack at more than $108 million. Its CEO says the situation could be worse if they hadn't taken special protection measures around energy infrastructure targets beforehand.
We have at least 2 levels of protection. The first level is barriers made of sandbags. The second level is specific shelters that protect from direct drone hits.
But Kudryski says this protection is not enough. He, along with Ukrainian military analysts, say more air defense systems are needed.
We need to cover at least the biggest cities. Ideally, there should be 2 surface-to-air missile systems for each. That means 2 for Dnipro City, 2 for Zaporizhia, and 2 for Odessa, Lviv, and Kharkiv.
Top Ukrainian officials, starting with the president, have consistently made a case for continued military aid from Western allies, highlighting the urgent need for enhanced air defense systems.
Russian terror is only possible now because we don't have enough modern air defense systems. In other words, frankly, because our partners lack the political will to provide them. They all know exactly what is required and who can make life-saving decisions.
Ukrainians see support from Western allies weakening compared to what it was at the beginning of the full-scale invasion. A $60 billion aid package for Ukraine passed U.S. Senate in February, but is stalled in the House of Representatives. Its future is uncertain, as public opinion polls show U.S. voters focusing on issues other than Ukraine during this election year. Lesya Bakalets, VOA News.
The State Department says U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will discuss support for Ukraine during talks in Paris next week with French President Emmanuel Macron. Friday will mark 1 year since Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich has been behind bars following his arrest by Russian authorities. Friends Gershkovich made in Moscow are now among the most vocal advocates for his release.
This is the first time that a journalist, a foreign correspondent accredited by the Russian Foreign Ministry, has been arrested in Russia, has been detained since the Cold War, you know, since the Soviet Union. And even then, I think that was a very different kind of case. It was a short detention, whereas now Evan has been in prison for a whole year. I mean, no one could have expected this. It was a real shock.
Russia is accusing Gershkovich of espionage without offering evidence to support the charge. In a hearing this week, he was ordered to remain behind bars, pending trial at least until June 30th, the 5th extension of his detention. U.S. Ambassador Lynn Tracy attended the hearing on Tuesday and said Russia is using American citizens as pawns to achieve political ends.
The accusations against Evan are categorically untrue. They are not a different interpretation of circumstances. They are fiction.
The Biden administration says it is seeking the release of Gershkovich, who faces 20 years in prison. Russia's foreign ministry has said it would consider a prisoner swap, but only after a verdict in his trial, which has not yet begun. Violence and instability in Haiti are a threat to the country's citizens and also to the journalists reporting at personal risk on the latest developments. VOA's Robin Guess has the story.
Fear, violence, and anarchy are spreading in Haiti. Gangs rule the capital and key infrastructure, including some ports, and block food distribution. And the journalists capturing their actions take a great risk. The dangers are not new for Haitian journalists. Narrowly surviving a gun attack in 2022, Roberson Alphonse fled to the U.S. Here's Roberson Alphonse, head of national news for the Haitian news outlet Le Nouveliste.
I hope that nobody will experience that, but it's highly possible that we have Haitian journalists. We have to move and hide or flee the country for their own safety.
Alphonse still covers Haiti, but from the safety of the U.S., where he is a fellow at the University of Michigan. Journalists in Haiti have been killed, kidnapped, and assaulted in the past 2 years. Media watchdogs say it is one of the world's most dangerous countries for journalists. Here's Artur Romeo, head of Latin America and the Caribbean for Reporters Without Borders.
Journalists are kind of caught up in this crossfire between the violence, gang violence, and this institutional crisis. And they are targeted when they are trying to cover this.
Journalists on the ground fear the situation is worsening and say there is no way to avoid one of the most treacherous assignments, covering the gang. Here's Ange Sherry, a reporter for the Haitian Times.
They don't want hurting the country. And if you say the wrong things to them, you might be their next target. So it's almost at the point it's a necessity to talk to the gangs. I want to say some people don't agree with it, but it can get also very dangerous.
The gangs aren't the only threat. Sandra Lemaire, VOA's Creole Service Chief, recalls an incident involving one of her reporters in Haiti. Here's Sandra Lemaire, who is the VOA Creole Service Chief.
And he was threatened by a national police officer at gunpoint, threatening him to say, "Don't publish this because it makes us look bad."
Lemaire says she checks in constantly with her team on the ground to ensure they are safe. Again, Sandra Lemaire, VOA Creole Service Chief.
My biggest fear is that they'll be killed while reporting.
With the gangs in control and progress slow in forming a transitional government, media analysts fear for the safety of the journalists on the ground. Robin Guess, VOA News.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Lori London in Washington. The UN Refugee Agency is calling for urgent action in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where renewed fighting between the non-state armed group M23 and the army has forced hundreds of thousands of people in recent weeks to flee. World Food Program spokesperson Shelley Lacroix says over 4 million people have been displaced over the last 2 years, with the relentless violence laying bare to catastrophic consequences.
People have been uprooted from their homes, from their land. Not once, not twice, but multiple times. We, as the World Food Programme, we have to be there to give food assistance, to give cash, to make sure that these families don't face hunger, these mothers don't turn around and say, "I have no food to feed my children." And we also have to keep telling the international community Don't give up on these people, don't ignore these people, and don't let this situation be tolerated.
The UNHCR is calling for concerted international action to address the escalating humanitarian crisis and help restore stability to the region. South Sudan's government says schools will reopen next week following a two-week closure due to extreme heat across the country. With extreme heat events becoming more frequent and intense, USAID and the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies Thursday convened the first global summit on extreme heat. Julie Origi, acting director of the Red Cross Red Crescent Society's Climate Center, joins us for details.
It's bringing together leaders and change makers from around the world to discuss solutions and strategies to help protect communities from extreme heat.
What do you see as the most critical issues that need to be addressed?
So the risks of extreme heat are rapidly on the rise due to climate change, and extreme heat is deadly. But the impacts of extreme heat can be prevented with really focused, concerted action. So the goal of the summit is to raise awareness not only about the impacts, but also the potential measures to reduce the impacts of extreme heat, and hopefully spur on individuals, communities, thought leaders to join us in that action to reduce the impacts of extreme heat. Just for some examples, you know, a study that came out in Nature recently estimated that in Europe in 2022, roughly 60,000 lives were lost due to extreme heat. These are staggering numbers, and it's not only in Europe. You see thousands in other countries as well where it's reported, but it's a silent killer. So you don't see it. It doesn't have that same visual impacts that you might see for other types of disasters like a hurricane or a tsunami or things like that. And so the purpose of the summit is to really raise awareness about these large impacts with the goal of reducing them.
Will you be determining the needs and ways to address the challenges in order to sort of build awareness, or setting action plans as far as how to address the challenges?
So the summit is convening thought leaders from around the world that are working on this topic already. And it's also launching something called the Extreme Heat Action Online Hub, which will be a space for people to come together and exchange information and strategies about types of actions they can take. And through this summit, the USAID and IFRC are also calling on different stakeholders, governments, multilateral development banks, philanthropies, et cetera, to join in this effort. So for example, national and local governments are being called on to commit to develop something called heat action plans, which should outline the ways you can prepare and respond during extreme heat events, to strengthen early warning systems and to issue guidance to protect vulnerable people. And there will be, for example, speakers speaking to examples of this work going on around the world. Other examples are our own USAID missions, or in our case, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, those national entities working to raise awareness locally about these risks, looking to encourage youth leaders, civil society, innovators, mappers, etc., to take actions within their communities. This could be things like increasing shade cover by increasing green spaces, taking innovative things like cool roof approaches, which can be painting roofs white to reduce indoor temperatures, mapping vulnerable populations so you know how to prioritize risks, a variety of these actions, for example, to again help reduce the impacts. And this will be a sprint leading up to something called Heat Action Day on June 2nd, but also a commitment for the longer term, because many of these actions are long-term commitments, such as retrofitting in urban spaces, some of these cooling strategies, and some of them are also those response sort of measures when an extreme heat event is actually happening to help get the word out and reduce impacts.
Right. And this is the first, obviously, with all the plans you have in place at the trajectory we're going, the planet, likely things will get even hotter and there will be a greater need.
Exactly. So this is, you know, the beginning of a summit to really raise this awareness, but the types of commitments we're making are for the long term, because this will be a risk that continues to rise and that we will need to take these actions to reduce those risks. And so some of that is the short term, but many of it is the long term. Like if I take from an urban perspective, there's not only the retrofitting space that already exists, but if you think about cities that are growing, it's also, you know, local governments thinking about how heat risks are changing over the lifespan of a city, which is decades and centuries, and to build in those considerations of how to keep a city cooler when the city is being built even, or when the city is growing, like making sure there's adequate green spaces so people have places to go to cool off, or water infrastructure. And from that perspective, I mean like spray parks for cooling. There's a great example of that from the city of Cape Town, for example, where playgrounds can be converted into spray parks during extreme heat events so kids can stay school school. Those are examples of those like longer term commitments where you kind of build them into the fabric of society to help reduce the impacts of extreme heat in the long run.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks so much.
Julia Righi, Acting Director of the Red Cross Red Crescent Society's Climate Center. And that ends today's program. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Lori London.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.